This is Wine, Women, and Revolution with your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio.
Hi, and welcome to Wine, Women, and Revolution. I'm your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio. You can find us online at www.njrevolutionradio.com. Follow us on all the social medias and get us wherever you get your podcast from. Today, I have someone with me. Her name is Sabrina Strings. She's the author of Fearing the Black Body, The Racial Origins of Fat Phobia. Welcome to the show, Sabrina.
It's great to be with you, Heather.
So first off, I wanted to say, you know, that I loved your book. I saw an article about your book. I think it was Mark Lamont Hill had tweeted it out. And before I even finished reading the article, I was on email trying to reach out to your office to get you on my show. That was how exciting I found your book. So I'm really glad that you can be here today.
Oh, well, thank you so much for those comments. It really does help. It's uplifting to hear thoughts such as that.
So the first question is, what sparked you to write this book? It's a fairly unique topic. So how did you get to doing the research and writing this book?
Well, so I began in 2003. In 2003, I was working in an HIV medication adherence clinic in San Francisco Bay Area, a neighborhood known as Bayview Hunters Point, which at the time was predominantly Black. And so I was a research assistant for this program, and it was my job to interview participants about their HIV medication usage. And in one day, I talked to two different women, and each of them said to me that they were not taking their HIV meds because they were afraid of gaining weight. Wow. And this was mind-blowing because I thought, the stakes are literally life and death, and yet they're willing to risk death in order to not gain weight, to effectively remain their current size. And it sort of triggered a memory of conversations that I'd had with my grandmother. My grandmother moved from rural Georgia in 1960 to California, to Los Angeles, California. And it was the first time in her life that she had seen so many people on diets. As you might imagine, in rural Georgia in 1960, this is the middle of Jim Crow, people aren't doing their utmost to lose weight. In fact, people are doing everything that they can to get as much food as possible. And so she was like confused, to say the least, by this. So that in the 1990s, when I was a teenager, she would consistently ask me, like, why are white women on diets? Like, what is this? And because it was something that she had puzzled over for years, and I never had an answer for her during her lifetime. But after my encounter in 2003, I decided that I would research this.
And it developed over the years into Fearing the Black Body. So that's great. And actually, you talked about something. I want to get more into like the topics of the book, but you did hit on something that you mentioned in the book, that for long periods of history, it really was just white people that had this fascination with slimness. And for the large part, people of color kind of didn't even know what was going on.
Right. So that was one of the more fascinating findings to me, which was that all that I basically had to do to begin this project was just to take a look at women's magazines from the 19th century. So many people who are listening to this may be unaware that Cosmopolitan actually began in the 1890s. And Harper's Bazaar began in the 1870s. And so there is this long trajectory of some of these magazines. And I just decided to say, well, what were they telling women in the 19th century about their appearance? Was it the same thing that women are being told today? And it turns out that one of the first things I found in my research was an article describing this, the beauty of some local woman because she was a Scotch Highlander, which meant she had skin this color, and she was tall and she was thin, which meant that she was also, you know, part Anglo-Saxon. And I was like, what is happening? And that formed the basis of my dissertation, so that when I went back to rewrite this, and the rewriting really began about 5 years ago, I decided, let me see what took place between the Renaissance, when these more voluptuous and curvaceous women were prized, and the 19th century, the time period by which I knew from the dissertation that this relationship between whiteness and thinness already existed.
Right. And I thought it was how kind of how you started off your book. And for me, it was very fascinating since I do art as my day job, was you really went through and looked at representations of people of color in classical paintings and just women in general in paintings. And what did you find that was different? And what was the turning factor of when things started to change?
So many of us are familiar with the paintings of people like Albrecht Dürer or Titian, in which women appear to be more voluptuous than we would see today. And in fact, that was the mainstream standard in the Renaissance. What I noticed was that during the time of Peter Paul Rubens, and many people associate him with the beautiful and voluptuous nudes that he drew, by the time of Rubens, in his own journal, he had written that the most beautiful women in the world had skin white as snow. And this was a departure from what I was seeing in some of the early artistic renderings and then also the journals that artists had left. And the difference was really the rise of the slave trade. So that we have in some of the paintings by Dürer or Titian, African women do appear, but they're considered to be equally beautiful, at least in terms of the physical body, as white women. But with the rise of the slave trade, what we see is that now they're attempting to make a hierarchy, a distinction between Europeans and Africans.
And this was sort of the beginning of how they were trying to justify to themselves this travesty they were committing on people, that they started othering people and saying that they were different and inferior. And that was even showing up in art of the time.
Yes. That's right. And so I think when we think about art today, as I'm sure that you are sort of an expert and you're sort of well aware of this, that people think that art is somehow separate from politics or separate from intellectualism, like it's some creative endeavor that exists in a vacuum. But what we notice when we look back at the Renaissance and the Enlightenment is that people who were artists were often also philosophers. So they were part of the circle of intelligentsia, with whom like various important ideas of the day were exchanged. And so we would expect that artists would depict some of the important cultural and political shifts that were taking place.
Yeah, and that's very cool. Like I've talked about the power of art a few times on the show before, that it really documents things that aren't necessarily being written down in other places. And that fascinating me that you found in art proof of exactly what you're talking about, that body standards have changed and how we view different color skin has drastically changed. I mean, I think it's not surprising to anyone, especially if you're listening to this show, that the European beauty standard has been pushed on us. But, you know, from coming from an anti-capitalist perspective, I've often like kind of pinpointed in on, oh, capitalism is trying to sell us things. But really, you kind of plugged in a major missing piece here with the racism inherent in this slim ideal. And I thought that was fairly fascinating.
Yeah, I think there had been a number of critical and important works in which people described the relationship between class and weight, because we had noticed that in American society for decades that it was people with the most money, the wealthiest individuals in society, who tended to be thinner and also who tended to adopt this ideal of fitness. Which I'm sure we've seen depicted in many different films from the 1980s, right? Sort of like we could see the middle class people running to stay in shape. And of course, when you look at data from medical researchers, you will also notice that there's this class divide in weight. And so I think that a lot of people had done important work on that point, but the racial component, I thought, hadn't been fully explored.
No, it really hadn't. I had not seen anything. That was why I was so fascinated that I wanted to read your book right away, because it really had not been explored. And aside from othering people, you also uncovered that there was a lot of religion tied into this, creating this thin ideal.
That's right. And I think for many of your listeners, it's sort of like, ah, yes, you know, we know that there's some type of Protestant ethic within the United States, and that this idea of sort of disciplining yourself, being rational, being self-controlled, that there have been many theorists who have suggested that this comes out of sort of like this Protestant shift or the shift toward Protestantism that took place in Europe in the 16th century. And so then what I saw in my research was that by the early 18th century, as Protestantism was really spreading throughout Western Europe, there was this very clear religious rationale for people to eat as little as possible. And so I talk about this man who was almost going to head into the clergy, but ended up being a diet reformer instead, who went around proselytizing largely to audiences packed with women about the necessity of eating right for God, which to him included eating a lot of fruits, maybe a little bit of nuts, but relying largely on milk, because these were all foods that were not stimulating and that would not build, in his estimation, excess flesh.
Excess flesh. I love how he describes that. So much judgment is placed upon women's bodies throughout history. This hasn't changed. Like, I think that's one of the things that you saw, that throughout history, there's a lot of men writing about what the ideal beautiful woman is.
Right. That was so strange to me, because we don't often talk about that when we talk about race science. Like, so much of race science has described how men have degraded other men to make them into slaves, or, you know, to make them into laborers in sort of like internment camps or on railroads. And all of that is an important history. But they haven't noticed that since the beginning of race science, the very first race scientific treatise was really about trying to create like a geolocator for hot chicks. Okay, in China, the women look like this. In Egypt, they look like this. And so, like, just going around the world and trying to describe what women look like. And to me, I was like, I want to do more work here, because people haven't attended to the centrality of race science and being able to hierarchically order the women of the world.
And I think you illustrated really well that they would, the same people, like the exact same group of people, as time progresses and as the slimness ideal developed, they're being described totally differently, even though it's the exact same people with the exact same body types.
Yeah. Right. I mean, so we take a look at what was happening, for example, in South Africa with the women of the Khoisan tribe, who would have been considered either Bushmen or Hottentot by the Dutch and then later British colonists. And so at some points you can see them being described as an exceedingly sort of dark-skinned, small, slender people. And then later they're lighter skinned. And then later they're actually quite fat. And it's sort of like there's all of this contradiction that's happening. And in reality, I'm sure if we were to actually meet members of the tribe, we would find that they have a variety of skin tones, a variety of body sizes, because there's a tremendous diversity amongst any group of people. And yet there was always this attempt to try to pin them down as being inferior based on the current model of what made Africans distinct from Europeans.
Right. And it was a way of saying that Europeans were somehow better. And there was a lot of discussion about what constitutes an actual white person, too, that for a while, like the Irish were described kind of in the same way as they were trying to other people of color. They were trying to other the Irish as well.
Yes, and that was actually one of the more interesting findings for me, because I did not necessarily set out to become a scholar of Irish American history, and yet at the end, I actually did feel like I knew a great amount about Irish American women in the United States. The reason being that when I was searching for terms like black within the various women's magazines in the 19th century, for instance, frequently the Irish would appear in my data, and I thought, well, what? How is this happening? Like, why? I would actually find in a lot of these magazines more discussion of the so-called Black Irish than of Africans or African Americans. And it was one of the ways in which I was able to understand on a deeper level, like, the falsity of race. Can we learn when school that race is a social construct? And that maybe seems a little bit amorphous. But to be able to see very clearly how one group, the Irish, were white, and then they became black, and then they became white again. Really to understand the fictitious nature of racial categorizations.
Yeah, and I think, because I kind of sat and read your book kind of from cover to cover in one sitting, the pure ridiculousness of all of this, like, really stood out when you're watching these same groups of people. Okay, they're this way, and then they're this way, and then they're this way.
Right. It's like, but what? What is the basis for these changes? But it was just really like shifts really in within the political organization. Okay, well, now we're sort of more aligned with people in Northern Italy, and so we think that the Southern Italians look like this. You know, that there was always some political foundation to these racial reorganizations.
Right. And at least in America, this was deeply tied to immigration at the time, too. It was who the immigrants were, and it was an anti-immigrant sentiment as well.
Yes. And I think for some people who are reading this, who are interested in this particular relationship between immigration, race, and aesthetics, you will notice that there was all of this negative depiction of the Irish, you know, of their character. There was like this attempt to degrade fatness and link it to a denigrated Irishness. And then within 30 years, we can see that the Irish have assimilated in the United States, and they're just one of the many groups considered to be whites. Whereas the Russians, Polish people, Jewish people who were the new immigrants at that time period, this is the late 19th and early 20th centuries, suddenly they're the ones who are swarthy and also fat. And like these are indications that they're part black and therefore inferior.
Right, because they tried to say, I think a lot that you pointed out, that the people that were fat were inferior, and that they tried to, I guess, portray people of color, no matter how they described it at the time, as gluttonous and amoral and all these kind of terms. I don't know, it's angering, of course, but, you know, it's really strange to see how people can delude themselves into believing that. I know that's not exactly the topic of your book, but
but I think it's actually helpful for us to recognize it, like what you're talking about, that there's this delusion that exists, but it feels so real. And that can even be applied to our current understandings of quote unquote obesity. I remember when I was in graduate school and I was really just beginning this research, I was speaking to another graduate student, otherwise an intelligent man. And, you know, I remember him saying to me, I can look at a fat person and tell they're unhealthy. And my response to him is, what you've just described is eugenics. We don't have the right to think we can look at someone and know their health status. That's silly. But it seems logical at the time. When he said it, it seemed to make perfect sense. So we can see how all of the negative understandings that we're getting about various groups and about their bodies, we take for granted as natural. And it's not until we start investigating the history of these things, the roots of these relationships, do we notice just how preposterous they are.
Right. And the medical field has been diluted. I think you do talk about that a bit, that the medical field has been caught up in this anti-fat bias, where they do form a connection that may not necessarily be there, that I think you talked a little bit about. If you're a tiny bit overweight, you actually have better longevity outcomes, right?
Yes, that's true in the United States, and it's also true in other countries like Germany, where data does exist. I think for me, one of the fascinating things about performing this research was I started to ask myself, where did BMI come from? Is it the case that there were a number of scientific experiments conducted that led to some medical consensus based on the research that this is the body mass index, which is a measure of weight to height, that the entire world would need to adopt in order to be healthy? I mean, so when I say that, we can already start to think, huh, that probably won't work. Why should we have the same bodily standard for men and women, and also for people of all racial, ethnic identities in all parts of the world? That seems already to be unlikely. And what I discovered was that it wasn't a matter of medical consensus, at least not based on scientific findings. But there was one man in particular in the medical community, his name is Ansel Keys, who was pushing for the institution of BMI as the gold standard for measuring so-called adiposity or fat on the body. Now, of course, we know how problematic BMI is, and yet we're still using it to determine people's health status.
I mean, and that reminded me of something else that you mentioned in the book was at the time, it was like the insurance actuarial tables that seemed kind of made up because they talk about medium frame and large frame without ever defining any of that. And it was just purely out of like a capitalist construct of insurance at the time where these tables came from.
Yes. And I also want to mention the work of J.J. Broomberg and Fasting Girls, which is a book that I read years ago. I think it came out in like the late 80s, in which she also talked about the significance of these weight tables. And I remember thinking, oh, okay, but this surely this can't be the true foundation. You know, it's sort of you read a book and it moves you. But it's not until, at least for me, I started to do research and could see, again, not just the fact that there was very little science, but the tremendous power of the insurance companies that was then challenged by Ansel Keys, in fact, in his construction of BMI, that I could see, oh, even within medicine, which we hope will be objective, there's all of this, there's all of these ways in which politics and money are actually driving a lot of what we consider to be medical standards.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, well, I'm preaching to the choir a little bit here because my audience is very anti-capitalist, but it does control so much of our lives that it is setting our definitions of who we are. And that should never be happening. Allow people to define themselves. Don't set these outside definitions for them.
Yes. I think that's why it's so important that there's this movement, Health at Every Size, in which we simply allow people to be who they are. But what we attempt to do is to encourage, like, Americans, for one thing, because this is a tremendous problem. Fat phobia is a tremendous problem in our country. But also medical practitioners to view all bodies as equally valid, and yet to try to give advice where possible, and also resources, that's important, for healthy living. So, for example, not just telling people they should eat fruits and vegetables, but being a part of a public health initiative that encourages the free and available access of fruits and vegetables, especially to low-income populations who may live in food deserts and may not have access.
Yeah, and we've talked about food deserts here on the show quite a bit, that right here in New Jersey, in Camden, they don't have a grocery store. It's literally just, this is a large city with lots of people. There's no grocery store. It's just little bodegas and corner markets.
Yeah. You know, and I'm sure that people get a lot from the bodega, and I'm sure that they're very fond of them in the community, but there's something to be said for having a place where you can go to know that you can get fresh produce. And I'm not sure if that's going to be the case in some of the bodegas that may be in local communities. So so it does raise significant questions about how we expect people to adopt healthy lifestyles if we cannot guarantee that there's going to be somewhere that they can go to be able to access nutritious food.
Exactly. And I did want to tie it back because we've gotten off subject a little bit and not so much talking about race, but you did mention eugenics. And eugenics does play a role in your book for sure. And I wanted to add that, like, you start to, I've always kind of been interested in the Kellogg and Graham people. When somebody told me in college once, you know, Graham crackers were invented to keep you from masturbating.
Oh, yes. Yes.
So seeing Kellogg and Graham and all those mentioned in your book really was like, oh yeah, I remember back in college. But there was a big role of eugenics in race science and the slim ideal. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. Actually, I think you were exposed to more than I was, because I definitely remember reading about Sylvester Graham and his anti-masturbation campaign, especially as it applied to young men. But I didn't know so much about John Harvey Kellogg. And as I was researching this book, and I was just sort of looking for any information, again, especially in high-profile sources. So for the aesthetic portion, I was looking in top women's magazines. But then for the medical portion, obviously, I was looking in top medical journals. And what happens when you do that is that you will run across multiple articles written by John Harvey Kellogg in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Because he was a respected physician, not just a purveyor of fine breakfast cereals, which is how we know him today. And part of his whole crusade was to encourage white women to eat more, actually, to add healthy flesh. Because in his estimation, women's magazines had gotten women on the entirely wrong track. They had gotten to be too slender by taking the advice of women's magazines. And so he was stepping up as a doctor to offer, in his mind, a corrective. We're going to get our women to the correct weights. We're going to get them to eat right, to gain flesh, because, in his mind, this is how we will secure the future of the most racially elite nation.
Right. He wanted to make more white babies, and this was how he thought it was going to happen.
Yes. That's exactly it. And so he spent a great deal of his career writing about that.
I mean, and part of that, too, was this belief at the time of the inferiority of other races. And I think, I don't remember, was it Kellogg that had said, like, oh, well, all the other races will just die off because they're purely inferior. And we just have to secure the future of the white babies.
Right. So his idea was that black people in particular, he called them blood clocks. You know, basically they're ticking time bombs. They're definitely going to die off because they're racially inferior. But to secure the white race, we need to make sure that we give people the best possible models. So we need to tell them how to eat. We should tell them also how to look. And so that was part of what he was invested in.
It was amazing how many different sources you could lay out that all kind of show the same racial bias that I think most people probably have not thought about yet. So I think you're challenging some perspectives, and that's a lot of why I wanted to have you on the show. Did you set out to challenge this, to challenge people with this, or was it just, here's what I found?
Well, no, actually, when I started doing this work, as I mentioned, I sort of came to it through personal reasons and then also familial reasons for my relationship with my grandmother. And so I thought, well, I just want to find out why it is that dieting is this massive preoccupation. There were other scholars who had written about this, and they would say things like, in the early 20th century, most Americans appear to be on diets, but we don't know why. And I thought, well, I want to try to figure this out. However, interestingly enough, pretty much from the beginning, I was getting a good deal of pushback. I was being told that this research had already been conducted, but people couldn't tell me who'd done it. I was being told that it couldn't be known. So it's like, this is why these questions have not previously been investigated. It simply can't be known. I was told in 2013 that my work was dangerous by a scholar of public health. And so there were so many people who were trying to discourage me. And even one person told me while I was still in graduate school, why don't you just tell people how to lose weight? As if there aren't already tens of thousands of manuals instructing people on the best diets. And so I thought, no, I'm not going to do that because the market is saturated. And also, this is not my political leanings. So it was definitely not that I was setting out ruffle feathers, but I absolutely have along the way, which is fine.
Yeah, I can imagine, especially in the weight loss. I don't know, like, is it a weight loss industrial complex? Can I call it that?
I mean, I think that's fair, like a beauty industrial complex, for sure. And there's another work that I want to mention. The book is by Natalie Borrero, and it's called Killer Fat. And her book was actually very helpful to me when I went back, because what she's doing is she's showing all of the various weight loss organizations, Jenny Craig, Weight Watchers, et cetera, that were lobbying the federal government to make body size a priority for their healthy populations manual. And they were ultimately able to get their wishes granted.
Yeah, and I think that's so great that you did something, or have produced something that challenges and pushes back and says, you know, maybe you need to think about where your perceptions come from. Because challenging perceptions is one of the most important things I think that we can do. Because people sometimes just believe things just because that's what's believed. And when you can challenge that and make people really evaluate that, is when you can change the world. And so I'm going to include you and, you know, the people I really look up to, that you're trying to change the world, even if that wasn't originally your goal.
Well, thank you so much for that, Heather. You know, and I feel like there's been overwhelming love and support for the project, which is not to say I have not gotten my fair share of hate mail, because I have. But that has been minimal compared to the outpouring of people who have said to me, like, I had never thought about these relationships, but thank you so much for doing this, because it makes me feel like, as a lowly academic, somehow my work is helping people, and that's important.
You probably also get, I'm guessing, quite a bit of fan mail of people who maybe grew to accept their bodies a little more because of your work?
I think so. Well, you know, maybe it's been a short period of time for that tremendous impact on maybe the individual level. But I feel like people are now having more conversations. And that's what I've been privy to. Like, people questioning, like, oh yeah, why is it true that women are supposed to spend so much time trying to maintain as small a figure as possible. Like, where, like, how did we come to that? And why do we have to hold on to it? I think that's the interesting moment for me, when people start going, wait a minute, we don't have to do things this way.
So what's next? Are you working on something else now?
I am, actually. So one of the things I've been interested in the past couple of years is thinking about California history. And because I'm a native born Californian, one of the things that I've noticed is that, first of all, we're not told very much about California history growing up, which is strange, because I have, from the time I was in kindergarten through now I'm a professor, always been educated in California, and yet didn't learn very much about California history in the schools that I attended. So I wanted to be able to think about, what is the contribution of Black women to the history of Los Angeles in particular? When we're seeing Oscar So White, and when we're hearing about West Coast rap, all of those narratives are about white persons or about Black men. But what is the role of Black women? And so my new book examines that. Who are the Black women who made LA? I'm going to tell you.
And where can people get books, either Fearing the Black Body or your new book about women, the Black women who formed LA?
Well, that book, they can't get the second book yet because it has not been written. But they can follow me on Twitter at S.A. Strings. You can also check me out on raceandyoga.com. And also academia.edu for those of you who are affiliated with universities. It's a cheap and easy way to be able to get access to most of the articles of I've written about this and other topics over the course of my career.
Well, I definitely encourage people to check you out. Did you have any closing words that you'd like to get the last word for today?
I suppose I would just say that fatphobia is not rooted in medical concerns. It's rooted in race science and also Protestantism. Hopefully knowing that will help us to move against fat stigma in our society.
Thank you again so much for being here. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Same here, Heather. It's been a pleasure.
To my listeners, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate you so much here. We try to be the voice of the world changers, of the activist community, of the stories that you aren't hearing that much in mainstream media. And we couldn't be here if it weren't for you that support us. Since we are trying to be the voice of the activist community, we take no corporate money here on NJRR. We are only taking money from you guys. So we have to ask you, if you have a couple of extra dollars that you can kick in, go onto our website, www.njrevolutionradio.com, and click on that donate button. We appreciate everything you do to support us. The future is yours to create. Go out there and create it.